Firstly, I want to thank Scott and Abby, as always, for opening your home and being a place where whenever there's someone who has any kind of adventure, they know Scott and Abby are up for it. That said, their home is open. We really appreciate it. So thank you. Abby, thank you very much. Ab, wherever you are, we appreciate you. I want to thank Dr. Paul and Esther for giving us this extraordinary opportunity. Rabbi Steinmetz, for those who do not know, is the Silver Family Rosh Kollel of the Jack and Gitta Nagel YU Community Kollel in Los Angeles. It's quite a title. It took me about 20 minutes before I got in there.
You know how much it costs?
Well said. I can tell you, I was in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago, and I was at a Shalom Zachar. It's one thing, I go to Rabbi Steinmetz teaches the Shalom Shudis slot at the Young Israel Century City by my father-in-law. In Abbas Torah, the Shalom Shudis slot, I wouldn't say, is the crown jewel of adult education. In the Young Israel, in the Young Israel Century City, it is. Rabbi Steinmetz's predecessor was Rabbi Zev Wiener, who is world class, and people would come from far and wide, and whoever would fill that role had the unenviable task of following Rabbi Zev Shlita. And Rabbi Steinmetz has filled that role with aplomb and has taken it even to the next level. And people come and they look forward to Shalosh Shudis, and it's really he's created an amazing reputation for himself. And even beyond that, I was at a Shalom Zachar. And the young guys, the people talking about how the Kollel has brought Talmud Torah into their life, it's transforming the community in an amazing, amazing way. He's the force behind it. I would say that Rabbi Steinmetz and I were in Smicha together, but we were in a different track. I was becoming a rabbi, and he was becoming a Rosh Hashiva. And he is still very much on that track. The program's the same, but the hours are different. And it's really a tremendous chus for us. For many of us, you know, when Dr. Paul said, you know, we should have Rabbi Steinmetz, we'll do a shir, we'll do something, I said, people don't know Rabbi Steinmetz, but there's an asterisk. They don't know him yet. In 10 years from now, Rabbi Steinmetz will be a household name, like you hear Rabbi Ari Leibowitz, right? Everyone knows Rabbi Ari Leibowitz, so they're going to know Rabbi Steinmetz in 10 years from now. So you kind of get to catch a rising star, as they say. And if I haven't created too much of a expectation to satisfy, I hope Rabbi Steinmetz will take the microphone now. And Bechavod, it's a great honor to learn from you.
I don't want to ruin the introduction. I feel like we should just end here.
That was not bad.
That was great.
I prefer you keep going.
So I appreciate very much the very flattering and lie-filled introduction. It's very, very wonderful to be here. There's such a nice idea. I mean, I heard, you know, chabura, someone's house on a Monday night. You never know what that means. This is such a robust chever of people around the table. It seems like it takes place every week. Such a beautiful thing you have going. I know Rabbi Goldberg usually gives this year. And, you know, I'm sorry for that interruption, but hopefully we'll have some time to learn together in a different style, a different way, and that'll be a nice break, and then I'll get back to the real stuff, you know, next week, Amir Tashem. So I appreciate the hosts, the Hirschmans, for having us, really, and the Lehrers, who have become close friends over the last, not so long, a few months, but they're becoming closer and closer friends, and the greater family with which they're associated is very much supportive of our Kollel and very much a part of our Kollel's efforts and our Kollel's vision. So it's a wonderful synergy to be able to be here tonight and work together on Harbat Satora here on the other side of the country, or what I call America. So if you look in the first source, you have some psukim from the beginning of the Megillah, the third parak in Megillah Esther. It's in one of the cases in the Gemara. The Gemara offers, you know, different junctures at the points in the various points in the Megillah at which a person could really start from and get the whole story. Meaning the crux, the main ideas, the thrust of the story really begins at certain places according to the Gemara. One of those places is right here, Achar HaDvarim HaEla. After these happenings, after these things occurred, Then Achashverosh elected, he raised up, he elevated Haman to this lofty position as, you know, this senior, this chief officer. And it's at that point that the story really kicks into full throttle, when the animosity really turns up a dial, and people start to get involved in the Mordechai and Haman saga. This is where it all begins. But tucked away in these psukim, in this story, which is so important, are a few words that are interesting and beg some questions from us and make us look a little bit deeper for the understanding. But also, even in the words themselves, we'll see soon if we have time, there are some unique features here. There are some outliers in terms of the structure of the sentences. If you look with me in source number one, you have it in front of you, in the second pasuk, in the bold, V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech korim u'mishtachivim le-haman. Don't hold back your booze, that really ruins the shir. I happen to hold it ruins the Megillah too, but that's a different story. You can handle that in your own time. But certainly don't boo during the shir. V'chol avdei ha-melech, unless you really don't like the shir. V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech korim u'mishtachivim le-haman. That all of the avadim, all of the servants who were in the gateways of the palace, so they would bow down to Haman. Kichein tziva lo hamelech, because that was the command, that was the rule, that was the standing order, no pun intended, that you had to bow down. That when you saw Haman, you had to bow down in his presence when you were in that area, in that vicinity of the kingship of the Malchus. Now, it is interesting to note, we probably won't come back to this, but it's worth tucking away for homework, maybe ask Rabbi Goldberg on a different shir, that the double language over here is very fascinating. Korim u'mishtachavim. We're going to see it again in the next words. U'mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachavim. What does yichra mean? Bow down. What does mishtachavim mean? Bow down. So it sounds like the same thing twice. Now, the Gemara in Megillah, in a very different context, does tell us that kriya and hishtachava are two separate actions. One is when you bow down sort of in a halfway, and the other one is when you really spread out on the floor, like totally in submission. That being said, you can cover both by saying the bigger one. So it's interesting that the psukim here double up on those two actions. Again, we may not get to that, but it's worth exploring at another time. So here, the psukim tell us that the standing order was you had to bow down to the second in command, to Haman. And apparently, Mordechai lo yichra b'lo yishtachavim. Mordechai himself, Mordechai at Tzadik, would not do so. He would not cave, he would not bow down, he would not go ahead and be koreya u'mishtachavet to Haman in the place of the king. Okay, that's famous, we know this. This is his standing up against the wicked Haman. Next pasuk, Vayihi ki'amram elav, yom b'yom, v'lo shama aleim. He wouldn't listen, he wouldn't acquiesce. Vayagidu lehaman liros. They told Haman, they were looking and seeing, Hayamdu deri Mordechai, who will win this stalemate? Who will win Mordechai versus Haman? Ki higid lahem, now we're in the bold, asher hu Yehudi. Which, I guess if we literally translate it, means that he had told them that he was Jewish. Meaning, this is a pretty cryptic sentence over here, but basically the gist of it seems to be that Mordechai is defying the orders over here. Everyone's bowing down to Haman except for Mordechai, and we don't know exactly why. We don't know exactly what the context is. All we know is that Mordechai apparently defends himself by saying, and we only hear this through hearsay from the officers to Haman, but apparently Mordechai, so to speak, defends himself or explains himself by saying, Hu Yehudi, which means he's a Yid, he's a Jew. I'm Jewish, I don't do that. Okay, you're Jewish, you don't do that. There are a lot of other people who are doing it. So what's going on in the story? We're missing a lot of the background over here. So in order to try to just develop what exactly happened beforehand, what exactly happened in terms of the defiance of Mordechai, what was he not bowing down to, what was the point of his defiance, and in terms of trying to determine what his defense was, what was his argument, ki ani Yehudi, that I'm a Jew, what does that have to do with anything? Let's just backtrack for a second and see what is going on. Why were people bowing in the first place? So what do you guys think? Why were people in general bowing to Haman? Off the top of your head.
Fear, honor.
Good.
Royal command.
Good. Okay, so the first most obvious point is in the psukim, royal command, right? Tziva HaMelech. Okay, that we have in the psukim. Tziva HaMelech. So nobody can get around that. It certainly was a command of the king. Now, the next level of questioning is why? What's the command of the king? So then I heard fear and loyalty. So fear is a good point. So if you really fear someone, I mean, we do this nowadays a little bit instinctively. It's not so much bowing, but we cower. If you're fearful of someone, you cower. So you kind of crawl into yourself. You go a little bit into fetal position when you're scared of someone. Here, it's a little bit more decided. It's a little bit more purposeful. But you bow down. Out of fear is a good word for it. Loyalty, meaning pledging allegiance. A show of respect. We know each other. You came to Shir and Yilk once, right?
Possibly.
Have you ever gone to Shirat Yolk at the Hashkam Minyan? And have you ever heard me speak there?
Yes, yes.
So then it's definite, not possible, right? Okay. So nice to see you again. So you're correct. So out of a pledge of allegiance, of fear, like we said before, loyalty, a show of respect, those are all reasons that a person would bow down. Interesting to note, if you look in the Rashi script, which was not invented by Rashi, important to know that. Not invented by Rashi, maybe Rashi couldn't even read Rashi script, I don't know. But if you look in source number one, sort of the indented part over here in the Rashi script, when the psukim tell us kodim umishtachavim, Rashi inserts an idea over here. You think it's his own, but if you learn the Gemara's in Megillah, you'll realize that's not the case. He says over here kodim umishtachavim, they would bow down and bow down. Double language to Haman. She'asa atzmo eloha. What does that mean? He made himself a god. He deified himself. Lefikach u'Mordechai lo yechrov leishtachavim. That's why Mordechai was defying orders. That's why Mordechai wouldn't bow down. Now, where did Rashi get this from? This is not Rashi's invention. This is the Gemara says. The Gemara says this in two places in Maseches Megillah, and we'll talk about one place in Maseches Sanhedrin as well. The Gemara, I believe it's on Daf Yud and Daf Yud Test, and Maseches Megillah says that Haman was Ose Atzmo Eloha, which means he deified himself, he made himself into a god. We find that in other places in Tanakh. Where else? I think we say Paro did that, right? Paro used to go to the bathroom in the Nile River all the time. Why? Not because it was a spa resort, because he didn't want people to know he used the restroom. He wanted people to think he was a god. We have this all the time. Leaders in ancient societies tried to make themselves seem like they were all powerful, like they were omnipotent, and therefore they would deify themselves. So Haman apparently made himself into a god. Now, this doesn't have to go against what you said before. The Pasuk says the reason people bowed down was because the king said so. It could be the king said to bow down, and then Haman said, ooh, let me use this as a good opportunity. Everyone's bowing down. I might as well deify myself. I might as well make myself, you know, a power, an entity, something that people are worshiping. He could have just, you know, been riding the tide, so to speak. But those two things might jive. But the point is that what Rashi's saying is that here we see that Haman made himself into a god, lowercase g, and therefore Mordechai would not bow down to Haman. Why does that make more sense? Why does it help with the story? How does that help us understand it better? You're not allowed to bow down to Avodah Zarah. You're not allowed to bow down to... So it's a very simple story then, right? Meaning, Haman was a form of Avodah Zarah. Mordechai was a form of a Jew. And therefore, he wouldn't bow down. And by the way, the end of the story is, what does he say? Why am I not bowing down? Because I'm a Jew. I'm a Yehudi. A Yehudi doesn't bow down to Avodah Zarah. So it kind of all fits together pretty smoothly at that point, correct? The problem is, and this is... Yeah.
The Karim and Mishtachavim is a term that we use.
Oh, so we definitely do... Correct, correct. And that should make it worse, right? Meaning you're doing a godly act to a non-godly figure. That's an important point because we know from the Gemara's and Avodah Zarah, the Gemara's Maseches Sanhedrin rather, Avodah Zarah also, but predominantly Sanhedrin, with the Mishnayos over there, that that the acts of worship which are forbidden to an idol, to an Avodah Zarah, are those which we use in our service. Those are the main forms of service that are forbidden on a Daraisa level, on a biblical level. On a Darabon level, there's more things that are going to be forbidden, but you're correct. Taking what we do to God and applying it to other things is where the problem really sets in on a biblical level, absolutely. So we have Kriya Neshtachavo, we all bow down on Yom Kippur. That's a wonderful thing to do that to an Avodah Zarah. That's going to be a major problem of Israel Avodah Zarah. So ostensibly, that's what's going on over here. That's what's going on over here as well. The problem is it's not so simple. This is not an easy Gemara. It's very complex. We're not going to get into the details, not going to get into the weeds of it, but it's worth mentioning. The Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, you do not have it on your sheet, in Daf Samach Aleph, the Gemara there says that there's a concept of Oved Me'ahava U'Me'ira, which means that sometimes you have an individual who is worshipping an Avodah Zarah. It's very hard to define these terms. Very hard to define these terms. You look at Rashi, he says one thing. Tosa says a little bit different. The Rambam, you could spend your whole life trying to understand the Rambam. It's very difficult to understand. But the Gemara says Oved Me'ahava U'Me'ira. Wow, just translate it for me. You worship out of
love
and fear. I mean, that's okay, fine. But every Avodah Zarah probably, you worship God out of love and fear, correct? You have to have Yira from Hashem. So we have love and fear for God. And you imagine that if someone's a from a Shtarka Avodah Zarah, Oved Avodah Zarah, he also has a fear of his God, so to speak. He has a love of his God, so to speak. So Oved Me'ahava Me'ir is a funny term. What does that mean? How is that different than any other case of idol worship? So Oved Me'ahava Me'ira, says the Gemara, it's a machlokas Rava and Abaye, whether such a person is Pater or Chayiv, whether that person has violated the Isra Avodah Zarah, or whether he is obligated to give up his life in order to avoid doing Avodah Zarah in that case. Again, very difficult to understand what we're talking about because isn't that just a regular case of Avodah Zarah? We know Avodah Zarah is one of the big three for which a person has to give up their life, risk their life in order to avoid doing the Isser. That being said, the Gemara has a debate about it and brings proofs in both directions. In that context, the Gemara says that what's an example of Oved Me'ira? What's an example of someone who worships out of fear? The Gemara says Haman. When the people bowed down to Haman in the streets of Shushan, that was an example of Oved Me'ira, of worshipping Avodah Zarah out of Yira. And ostensibly what that supposedly means is that they weren't fearful, it wasn't like the gun was to their head, they were fearful of the malchus, meaning that was the rule, that was the gzeira, that was the ordinance from the king that you had to bow down, and out of fear of Haman, of the king, of the officers that were overseeing, that were elected to, you know, enforce this law, they were fearful of being of the retribution, and therefore they bowed down to Haman. That is the case of Oved Meira, according to the Gemara. Now, I streamlined a difficult Gemara, but do we basically get the concept? The Gemara is implying that there's such a concept of Ne'evad Kehaman, which means there's a type of Avodah Zarah, quotation marks, which is lesser form of Avodah Zarah than usual, when you're worshipping Haman. Make sense so far? Okay. Now, is there anything just objectively wrong with bowing down to a human being?
Are you allowed to do it for a Jewish king?
Do you tell me? You tell me. In an Avodah Zarah sense. In a, what was that?
No, I was going to say, if it's
A regular guy. Willie walks into the room, Rabbi Balk walks into the room, and I bow down to him. Anything wrong with that?
But there are some cultures
Good, there are some cultures, and do you ever find it on the books? Do we have it?
Yaakov Avinu.
Sure, Yaakov Avinu. Avram bows down to the Am Haaretz, right? Meaning you can even bow down to an Am Haaretz. Whoa, not even a Talmud Chacham. So you can bow down to people all the time. You have it all the time. Yaakov Avinu for sure. Rabbi Goldberg said there's so many examples in Tanakh of bowing down. So bowing down in and of itself is not really a problem. This is something that the Ran in his Chidushim there in Masechet Sanhedrin picks up on. That bowing down per se is not an issue. The issue is when you bow down b'toras Elohus, when you bow down in a deified manner, when you're saying, I'm bowing down to your holiness, to your sanctity, to your godliness. Okay, now we're talking about the sugya of Avodah Zarah, but in and of itself, we're not talking about an issue of bowing down. That's not per se an issue. It's only once you plug in the context. It's only once you contextualize it as, no, I'm an Avodah Zarah, all of a sudden there's an issue. So that is the first approach, and that
there
seems...
There's a little bit between bowing and prostration, carving the mishtachah.
For sure, for sure. Now, I don't know the details of when it will become Aser Daraisa or Aser Midarabanan, but we know in the story that it was both, so it's irrelevant for us, it's immaterial for us. But yeah, for sure there's a difference between those two, correct?
What about as a royal edict, the king said he had to bow down?
Very good. So I would have thought, and you know, nobody asked me, I wasn't around in Shushan, even if I was, they wouldn't have asked me because I'm a pulpit rabbi, I don't get shilas. I get, you know, people ask me about what's the pshat and tosas, they don't ask me what to do at home, which is it's better that way, I like it. I got the dream shilas this year. I don't get shilas. You deal with the shilas. I deal with tosas. But this year I got a dream shilas. People think I'm the Gadol Dor in LA. Someone called me and said that he listens to the shirim, so he might be embarrassed, but it's okay. I'm telling you, you dream of this shilas. He called me and he said he has a shilas, he doesn't know what to do. I said, what happened? So he said he bought I forgot what it was already. Something sausages. I forgot what it was. Something meat. And he poured it into his pot. His pot was made of cheres, earthenware pot. And he looked afterwards and he realized, I'm not making this story up. It was bacon. Not like, I accidentally, you know, poured something that had a little bit of bacon, like a bacon, a pig once kissed my meat. No, no, no. He put bacon into a kli cheres and cooked it on a hot fire for long enough that it was hot. So he asked me, what's the halacha? So he said, you know, I really need to consult this far in 1 second. Everything is treif, and you got to throw it out. There's nothing to do over here. This is like the best shayla ever. I was like, you couldn't find like a milchik spoon to mix it with that you haven't used in 36 hours? Like something. You couldn't put an onion in there to make this a little more difficult? No, you just put bacon into a pot and cooked it. Easy shayla. Other than that, I don't answer shaylas. But if I was in Shushan, and they would have asked me a shayla of, can I bow down because the king said to bow down? So I would have thought if it was a royal edict, that's not avodah zarah. That's a dina de malchus, a dina issue. It's something you have to, and you may be fearful for your life, and you'd give up your life if it was not avodah zarah. Once Haman contextualized it by saying, I am a god, that's when we see the issue come to play. So it's a good point, right? It's not the very fact that the king said to do it that's the issue. It's the fact that Haman contextualized it as an act of Avodah Zarah. So that's the first branch of thinking over here, is that there's an Isser Avodah Zarah that Mordechai is avoiding. Then you have to wonder, by the way, if that's true, we notice that everyone else in that courtyard is bowing down, correct? So what's the answer to that? Mordechai is the only one? So there's two answers. One is, yeah. Mordechai is the only one. Sometimes there's one tzaddik who stands up and no one else stands up. That's possible. The other possibility, and this is what the Malbim seems to be implying in his parish throughout this parak, is that who says everyone else was Jewish in the courtyard? Mordechai was the highest elected Jewish official. So he bowed down. So he wouldn't bow down. Maybe all the other Jewish elected officials were lower class. They weren't in that the area. They didn't ever bump into Haman, so it wasn't as much of an issue. Yeah.
The Gemara in Sanhedrin says people were afraid. That's why they did it from Europe. So what does it mean?
Yeah.
So it happened multiple times?
That's what it sounds like, yeah.
So the first time Haman's like, I'll give him a pass? It wasn't off with
it could be that Haman, you don't even get the sense from the Pesukim. It's a very interesting point. Even in the Pesukim, you're not even sure you get the sense that Haman noticed. honestly. It's only until afterwards when his subjects tell him, hey, you know, Mordechai is not bowing down, and he's saying it's because he's Jewish. You don't really get the sense until then that Haman is so incensed. He's so upset. He's so furious until later on. It's actually a fascinating point.
Maybe he was out of the room.
Maybe he didn't see, whatever, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. No. So that we'll talk about soon. The implication is that's not true. And he does it in later prek, and we didn't put it on the page, but it's very clear that Mordechai, even after he knows he's endangering the Jewish people, he still continues with this practice. So I think he did definitely defy him, you know, with a neck held up high, and it was obvious, but Haman only was somehow pointed that out. He didn't notice it on his own. Okay, that's the first strain of thought. If you look in source number two, you have a Tosas there on that, the Gemara that we mentioned. We didn't mention the Gemara inside, but the Gemara there, Tosas comment, they have a whole discussion about how is it possible. If it's really Avodah Zarah, that, like we said until now, then it should be a Har Gal Yavor, which means you have to give up your life. So Tosas twist and they turn, this is before the quotation, and they come up with a pshat where it's kind of neither here nor there. It's an in-between case. It's not 100% clear. Tosas then say, the Im Tomar L'Rava, if Rava says that in such a case of Ne'evad Kahaman, where you're worshipping Avodah Zarah, but it's this subcategory, where it's not real Avodah Zarah, it's a person made himself Avodah Zarah, everyone worships him out of fear, it's like this middle category, it's not real idolatry. So then if that's the case, Amai Lo Ishtachav Mordechai L'Haman. Meaning, if you have to give up your life for three mitzvos, you absolutely are not allowed to give up your life for the other mitzvos. So if someone says, break Shabbos or I'll kill you, if it's not a case of public nature, or it's not a case where it's a Shas HaShmad, where there's a big, you know, decree against the Jewish people, not only don't you have to, you're not allowed to keep Shabbos, you have to break Shabbos. If a person has a Rahman Aslan, a sick, you know, child on Shabbos, they have to go to the hospital. They're not allowed to choose, oh, I'll be frum and I won't go to the hospital. You have to break Shabbos in those situations. You have to do the Yisurim. So why over here, Mordechai had a pass. It wasn't real Avodah Zarah. It was like this in-between Avodah Zarah. So back out. So bow down. What's the big deal? Why does he have to be so defiant? So Tosas offer two answers. V'yesh Lomar, if you look inside in source number two. V'yesh Lomar. K'da'amra b'medrash. As it says in the Medrash, a Medrash that Tosas quote over here. Shahayud slamim al libo. What does that mean? Mordechai was wearing bling. He was wearing chains. He was wearing a necklace that had...
Haman.
What did I say? Oh my gosh, I drank too much before this year. I already lo yada between Mordechai and Haman. Okay. So we started the party too early. So Haman was wearing chains. He was wearing bling. Mordechai didn't wear bling. Mordechai wore a black hat. Everyone knows that. But Haman was wearing chains around his neck, and they had tzlamim. They had pestle. They had getchkas, things, idols on his neck. And basically, he had this great kunst, this great trick that he was going to get everyone to bow down to him. And what were they going to do in the meantime? They're going to be bowing down to all the Avodah Zarah. So he had a good kunst. Was he also a god? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Tosas don't really worry about that here. But what you were definitely doing when you bowed down to him, you were bound down to those Avodah Zarah, those idols that were hanging around his neck. What do you think of that answer? So Mordechai saw that and he said, oh, I noticed the chains, I noticed the Avodah Zarah. That's Yahar Vayavar, I can't bow down. What do you say to that? Any problems with that?
Close your eyes.
Close your eyes, you're still bowing down.
It should also be intent. Like, if his intent is just about
that. Excellent. So I'm not bowing down to the chains, I'm bowing down to the guy. I'm bowing down to the guy. He happens to be wearing something on his neck. So the truth is, we have almost a similar thing. You have, it's a questionable whether this is really the same sugya, but we have almost a similar thing in a Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah. The Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah in Daf Yud Beis says an interesting case where a person's walking down the street and they need a drink. They're so thirsty. The Gemara makes it sound like, in the Rishonim debate this, the person's so thirsty that he's not just parched. He could die from thirst. He's so thirsty. So he sees a nice water fountain. But the water fountain is attached to or in front of an idol. I don't know, maybe it's one of those water fountains where the water's coming out of the idol, whatever, I don't know. But it's right in front of the idol. Or he drops his coins, and he wants to bend down to pick them up, but there's an idol right in front of him. So he's going to have to bow down, bend over, to drink or to pick up his coins. And what's it going to look like? He's prostrating himself. You got to say that word right. Got to be very careful about that word. Prostrating himself, with the R in there, in front of the Avodah Zarah. That's what it's going to look like. So is that a problem? So the Gemara implies that it's absolutely a problem. So much so that the Ran, in at least one opinion there in the Gemara, assumes that a person has to give up their life, not to make it look like you're doing Avodah Zarah. What do we usually call that? Maris Ayin. Maris Ayin means that when an onlooker sees something you're doing, even though they're wrong, but they perceive it as inappropriate, you have to avoid that. You have to keep yourself so spick and span, your reputation so clean, that it shouldn't even look like you're violating an Isser. So here, I'm just bending down to drink some water. I'm just picking up my coins. But it looks like I'm bowing down to an idol, and apparently, I have to not only not do that, but risk my life in order to avoid doing that. It's an unbelievable statement of the Ran there in Maseches Avodah Zarah. Now, our case, whatever it is certainly no worse than that, or I should say, no better than that. Meaning, even if you want to argue, I think very legitimately and logically, that Mordechai has no intent to bow down to Avodah Zarah over here. He's bowing down to the guy because Achashverosh said I have to. And it happens to be he's wearing getchkas around his neck. It happens to be he's wearing a cross. It happens to be he's wearing, you know, a big fat, what do they call it, like a Buddha around his neck. He's doing, okay, it happens to be. That's not my intent. That's not what I'm trying to do. But it still looks like it. The onlooker will see you bowing down to that Avodah Zarah, and that is problematic. So it could be that Tosfos here are taking a stand on that problem. Either Tosfos are assuming that this is still considered worshipping Avodah Zarah, even though you don't intend to, which, like you said, is a little bit difficult, or Tosfos are saying, even though you're not literally worshipping Avodah Zarah, it's a Maris Ayin, which Mordechai realized he has to risk his life to avoid as well. A fascinating concept that Tosfos are bringing up here in Masechah Sanhedrin. That's their first suggestion. Their next suggestion, if you look with me in source number 2, at the end of the first line, the bold, the last word is E. So E Nami, which means there's a second suggestion, Mishum Kiddush Hashem. Kiddush Hashem just means that a person risks their life to avoid doing an Isser. But here what Tosfos are saying is something very, very important, very fundamental, not agreed upon by all of the Rishonim at all. It's a Machlokas and Shulchan Aruch as well. Tosfos here are saying, maybe Ein Hachi Nami. You're absolutely right. There was no obligation to give up his life. Mordechai did not have to defy the orders. He could have bowed down to Haman. It would have been fine. He was allowed to do that. He did not have to risk his life and the life of the entire Jewish people. He did not have to do that in order to avoid bowing down to Haman. But he wants to make a Kiddush Hashem. He wants to make a Kiddush Hashem. Meaning, apparently, Tosfos are saying, you are allowed to volunteer to give up your life for Kiddush Hashem. Even if the rules fall out in such a way, someone holds a gun to my head and says, break Shabbos, eat treif. Now, if it's in public, I have to give up my life. If there are 10 Jews in the room, I have to give up my life. If it's not in public, but it's a time where the Romans are persecuting us and trying to make sure we don't do mitzvos, I have to give up my life. That's Kiddush Hashem. But let's say it's not. It's private. It's there's no persecution. It's just a regular, when it's like the 5 minutes of Jewish history where there was no persecution, whatever. You're in the perfect time. There's no persecution. And they're holding a gun to my head and saying, break Shabbos. So I don't have to break Shabbos. Am I allowed to choose to? I'm sorry, I don't have to give up my life. I'm allowed to choose to? I'm allowed to say, no, I want to stand up and declare my values and stand up for Hashem and be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim by giving up my life. Am I allowed to do that?
Yes.
Tosfos seem to say yes. You know who says no? The Rambam says absolutely not. The Rambam Perek Hey of Hilchos Yisod HaTorah, Rambam's, all of his Hilchos Kiddush Hashem are contained in the fifth Perek of Yisod HaTorah in his Sefer Yad HaChazaka. So there he says black on white that that's not allowed. That if a person is not supposed to, doesn't have to, that means he's not allowed to. And this is an ongoing machlokas between the Baalei HaTosfos in various Masechtas, in Masechtas Ksubis, in Psachim, elsewhere as well, where Tosfos seem to again and again assume that a person is allowed to volunteer Kiddush Hashem, and they say Mordechai was one example of that. Mordechai maybe did not have to, by the books. He did not have to give up his life. He could have bowed down to Haman. It might have been a form.
Even if it was a minion?
If there was a minion, it would have been a case of Kiddush Hashem, correct. But we would be plugging what we assumed before, which is that even in the Shaar HaMelech, there weren't 10 Jews. It has to be a meaning of Jews. It can't be non-Jews.
It's a very loaded topic because during the Crusades, many Bnei Ashkenaz gave their life al Kiddush Hashem in ways that may not have been, strictly speaking, necessary.
Absolutely.
So that may partially account for a different sensibility from someone from Svard.
Absolutely.
Versus the Baalei HaTosfos.
The Baalei HaTosfos were certainly of that opinion.
Right.
Consistently. And it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. So it's not far off at all. It's definitely what to rely on, so to speak.
Right. But that historical moment may have some explanatory power for a slightly different perspective here.
And Rabbi Goldberg's point is also well taken. In the, you know, I forget who I saw this from. I feel like it was from the Shlah, but I could be incorrect. It was so long ago already. I believe that, you know, there are certain halachas, every rabbi knows, every real rabbi, again, not like me, knows that there are certain halachas you have to know. You don't have to know every halacha by heart. It's a secret. But you don't need to know every halacha.
Your title I need to know.
Yeah, that. Right. The title, that's it. That's what matters. But after that, you know, you can look things up. You're allowed to look up. You're supposed to look up. You need to use the books. But there are certain halachas you need to know on the spot. One of the most famous ones for rabbis that's very nerve-wracking is a Sefer Torah. That if you have a Sefer Torah on Shabbos afternoon that has a kuf that's a little smushed out, you can't tell if it's a hair or a kuf. You kind of need to know on the spot. You can't really run home and check the books. Everyone knows to call Katan, but nobody knows what to ask him. So it's kind of like a confusing thing to do. So one of the, I think it was the Shlah, but if it wasn't him, it was someone else with a beard, said that one of the areas of halacha that a person needs to know by heart, they can't consult the books, is the halacha of Kiddush Hashem. You don't get a chance to make, you know, a decision and go consult the books. People know the story about the bracha, whether it's a bracha on Kiddush Hashem or not. The Shlah had a bracha for Kiddush Hashem, coincidentally. But they say a story that there was Rachman Aslan, a non-Jew, who had a gun to a Jew's head, and he was telling him to, you know, break halacha. And the Jew said, you know, wait, I want to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. And he made the bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Asher Kedishanu Mitzvanu Al Mitzvos Kiddush Hashem Lekadesh Shem Shemayim Barabim, whatever the bracha is. And the guy was so scared, he started to run away. He was so scared. And the Jew runs after him, Hefzik, Hefzik, Hefzik. Right? You have to know the halachas on the spot. You have to know the halachas. So here, you know, it was applicable. whether you're allowed to volunteer or not volunteer, this came up many times in Jewish history. It'll come up again. Rachmanan Zlan, it'll come up again. So these are halachos that we do need to know. It's a major debate that goes all the way down to Shulchan Aruch, but apparently Tosfos Zayin are taking a stand on that, and at least in one opinion, assuming that you're allowed to volunteer, and that's in fact what Mordechai was doing. So I think the way that if we summed it up, we would see it is that there are basically three opinions here. Either Haman construed himself as an Avodah Zarah so much so that he became an Avodah Zarah. Okay, albeit a little bit of a lower level of Avodah Zarah, Oved Me'at Me'yira, as opposed to real Avodah Zarah, but Haman made himself into a bona fide Avodah Zarah, and therefore it was legitimate and maybe even necessary for Mordechai to give up his life, but there was room, I guess, for leniency, but mostly it was a case of Avodah Zarah. The second possibility is Haman himself may or may not have been exactly an Avodah Zarah, but he held those chains close to his heart, and anyone who bowed down would either be bowing down to Avodah Zarah, or it would look like that much, and therefore he had to give up his life, or thirdly, he didn't have to give up his life. It was a choice. He elected to do so because he wanted to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, just so you realize the stakes. The Gemara in Maseches Megillah, I believe, is on Daf Yud Beis, although the blot are so long, I get confused where it is, but somewhere in that area, Rava calls, interestingly, Rava, because he's the Man Damar in Maseches Sanhedrin as well, Rava actually calls Mordechai to task for what he did. He says, what are you getting the Jews in trouble over here? You could have avoided the whole thing. You didn't have to give up your life. You could have could have sidestepped it. You could have walked out. You could have gone to the rest. I have to use the restroom every time Haman comes in. Some weird disorder I have. Every time I see Haman, I have to go to the restroom. So, okay, so you could have figured a way out of it. Right, right. Instead of prostrating yourself, correct. So you could have avoided the whole issue. And you went out of your way to stoke the coals. Right? You ignited the flames over here. You got the Goyim upset at us. Why are you inciting? So Rav actually calls him to test. There are high stakes here. Mordechai was making a decision which may have been a volunteer decision which would change the course of history. It worked out for the better. You know, we won the war. It all worked out. But it's not a pashta thing, not a simple idea that Mordechai was making this decision over here on his own with the three ideas we mentioned before in mind. Okay, so that helps us with the background of the story. That's what people were bowing down to, and that's what Mordechai was trying to avoid bowing down to. But then we have that end of the story where Mordechai basically, I should say it differently, we're told that Mordechai expressed ki higid lahem asher hu Yehudi, that his, it's not a defense, but his explanation was that he's a Yehudi. His qualification was that I'm Jewish. I don't do this, correct? So what's that about? So if you look in source number 3, the very cryptic Medrash, the answer to the Medrash is not hard at all. The answer is beautiful, and we may come back to it. But the question is actually the cryptic part. I didn't really understand the question until my Rebbe, Rav Tversky Shlita, pointed this out years ago. At this point, it must have been 9 years ago. Where he pointed this out. But this question is a very interesting, the question behind the question is very interesting. The question on this pasuk, the Medrash says, Ma amar lahem Mordechai. What did Mordechai say to them? What does that mean? Ma amar lahem Mordechai. Limisha omar lo ma du'a to over es mitzvah zemelech. Those people who said to him, hey, why are you violating the ordinance of the king? What did he respond to them? Now, the pasuk tells us that he said he was Jewish, okay. But what does the Medrash want to know? Maybe Mordechai didn't say anything. Isn't it possible that Mordechai just quietly didn't bow down? That he held his head up high and stood there with an Israeli flag while the pro-Palestinian protesters were waving their flags? He just stood there and stared at it. Why do you have to say anything? Does it have to be he said, Am Yisrael Chai? Couldn't it be that he just stood strong? No? Isn't that a strange question, the Medrash? Why are we asking what he said? Maybe he didn't say anything at all. Maybe he was silent. Isn't that also a defiance? Isn't that also a protest? So to understand the answer to that question, and the Medrash does answer it, we need a little bit of background in the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. This is a brilliant, fascinating, beautiful, and inspiring idea that I heard from my Rebbe that many years ago, and it's worth paying attention. You know, if you were out of it until now, maybe wake the guys, you know, on your left and your right, and it's worth hearing this idea. If you look in source number 4, there's a very famous, important story. There was an Isha v'Shiva Baneha. A woman, a Jewish woman, who had 7 sons, and the Roman emperor was, basically threatening to kill them unless they would worship Avodah Zarah. And if you read the Gemara, you'll see that one by one, each son, you know the story, but it's a Gemara in Maseches Gittin. One by one, each son said, absolutely not. No, no, we will not bow down. And the soldier kills each and every one of them until the very last son, and the mother makes a famous speech, and he kills all of the children. A crazy, crazy story of martyrdom in Jewish history. But you'll notice something very fascinating here. That in each and every instance, and I actually bolded them for you in the source sheet, in source number 4, in each and every instance, as the son is told, bow down to Avodah Zarah or I will kill you, the son responds with a pasuk. The first son says, Kasav b'Torah, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. It says, I'm your God, there are no other gods, I can't bow down. Kasav b'Torah, Lo yilach Elohim achirim apanai. There are no other gods. I cannot bow down. Son number 2. Kasav b'Torah, Zaveach l'Elohim yacharam. You have to look at the Ramban there, what exactly this pasuk means, but the Gemara is assuming that means that you can't shecht to avodah zarah. I will not bow down. Son number three is killed. Kasa b'Torah, lo yisesh shtachav le'el acher. Don't bow down to other gods, etc., etc., etc. In every case, the son doesn't just say, no, I will not bow down, and takes a bullet, but rather he says no, and he makes a speech. He quotes a pasuk. He says why he won't bow down. He declares the value of the Torah and says that in the face of that value, I will not cave. I will not bow down to avodah zarah. What's going on over here? Why is each son making a speech? Just take the bullet. You know, you're gonna make the sacrifice. Make the sacrifice. Why are you giving us a whole speech beforehand? It can't be each one of them had smicha. If each one has smicha, I understand. Every rabbi takes every opportunity. It's an opportunity to speak. They give you a microphone. A gun is just another microphone for a rabbi. So I hear that. But these kids, they weren't all rabbis. There were seven of them. So one of the kids had to be a doctor. So why are they all making a speech? Why are they all quoting psukim before they're killed? What's going on over here in the Gemara? So flip the page with me for a second. Source number five. The Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos. The Rambam wrote so many svarim. He's such a prolific author. We have a commentary on Mishnayos. We have a commentary... we don't really have a commentary on Shas and Yerushalmi. We have pieces of it here and there. But we have his Yad HaChazakah, which is the halachic sefer, his magnum opus that we know as Mishnah Torah. We have Mor Nevuchim, his philosophical work. So he also wrote a Sefer HaMitzvos. It's debatable historically exactly what the point and reason of the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvos was. Academics debate it and rabbis debate it, but either way, it's an authoritative and important work. So in the context of the Sefer HaMitzvos, when he's counting the 613 mitzvahs for us, he counts the ninth mitzvah. He says, "Mitzvah Chi'is," source number five, He shetzivanu lekadesh Hashem. This very mitzvah of kiddush Hashem that a person has to be mekadesh Shemayim, as the pasuk in Parshas Emor says, "V'nekdashti b'seich b'nei Yisrael." Here in the bold, "V'inyon zos hamitzvah." What is the concept of this mitzvah? What is the idea of the mitzvah of kiddush Hashem? Asher anachnu mitzuvim, we are commanded lefarsim ha'emuna hazos ha'amitis ba'olam v'shalo nefachi behezik shemazik. Now I would have said the mitzvah of kiddush Hashem is to not give in. To not cave, to not do averos in public, to give up your life. I could have said a million different ways, but I would have said the same thing. The Rambam doesn't say that, right? What does the Rambam say? Mitzuvim lefarsim ha'amuna hazos. The mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, apparently, is to declare publicly the values of our amuna, to declare Jewish values to the world. That's the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. How do you perform the mitzvah? When a person puts, Rahman al-Tzlan, a gun to your head and says, violate the Torah, and you defy those orders, you declare those values. That's true. But that's all a kiyum of this idea of being mefarsim ha'emuna hazos ha'amitis ba'olam v'shalo nefachi behezik shemazik. Come what may, whatever danger, whatever risk to my life I may incur, I will spread the Torah's values, I will teach emuna, I will teach faith and loyalty to the world, to God. That's my role, and that's the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. Now, apparently, if that's the case, Kiddush Hashem involves more than just not doing something. What does it involve? Teaching the world, espousing those values, declaring that emunah to the entirety of the face of the earth. And when the seven sons are faced with that ultimate challenge and told, bow down or I'll kill you, they don't simply say, put the bullet in my head. They say, Anoch Hashem Elokecha. Lo sheshtachav le'el nechar. That you can't bow down to another god. They declare the psukim of the Torah and say, these are the values for which we stand. They won't simply give up their life, but rather they take it as a teaching moment. Lefarsim ha'emuna hazos. We don't have time to read it inside, but you look in source number six. I put it in English, so it's easier. The psukim of Daniel, you know, it's hard enough to learn Tanakh as it is, but then in Daniel, it's all in Aramaic. So here it's in English for you. I typed it from the art school, so you really better take your time to read it later because I put it in my time. So, but you'll see there that the Hanani, Mishael, Ve'Azari do the same thing. As they're being thrown into the fiery furnace, they make a speech about the God of Israel and what they're sacrificing for. The goal of Kiddush Hashem is not simply to give up your life, but to declare the values to the public, lefarsim ha'emuna hazos, to declare the emuna to the entirety, to the face of the earth. That is what Kiddush Hashem really entails. And with that in mind, you start to understand that Medrash that we spoke about back in source number four, or three. Medrash had said that if Mordechai gave up his life, what did he say? What did he say when they told him to bow down? He said, no, what did he say? What do we ask? What do you mean, what did he say? Maybe he didn't say anything. Maybe he just stood by and didn't bow down. The answer is no, he must have said something. He must have made a speech. He must have declared the emuna to all of Shushan, to all of the world, of why he won't give in, because that is the role of Mordechai HaTzadik. That is the goal of Kiddush Hashem, lefarsim ha'emuna hazos. What did he say? And the Medrash goes on to answer. He said that my God doesn't tolerate avodah zarah, and he said there's only one God, etc. He says that these rishayim don't have a hold on me for the following reason, but he must have declared it because that's what a Kiddush Hashem ultimately is. It's teaching the values to the world that we hold so dearly by risking our lives, by standing strong. That's what we're trying to accomplish. We're Mekadei Shem Shemayim. That's what Mordechai was trying to say. In source number 7, in a very different way, but you'll see the Kedushas Levi picks up on some of these issues as well. The Kedushas Levi was a Chassidish Rebbe, of Levi Yitzchak Mibreditchev. So he explains that's what's going on when it says Asher Hu Yehudi, that Mordechai could have had a pass over here. It could be that people would have said Mordechai is not bowing down because, I don't know, maybe only, you know, elected officials at this level had to bow down, but not Mordechai. Maybe Mordechai was above and beyond that order. I don't know, maybe Mordechai had some other excuse. Maybe Mordechai did have some bathroom issue that he was always not there. Mordechai went out of his way to say, no, it's because I'm Jewish. It's not a coincidence. Don't think for a second that I got lucky and just didn't have to bow down. No. I didn't bow down, you know why? Because I'm Jewish, because I have values. Lefarsim ha'amuna. Mordechai made a point of showing everyone this is why. This is the reason. There's a goal here. There's a role I'm playing. Asher hu Yehudi. I'm a Jew, and I'm proud, and I'm saying that to the world, and that's why I won't bow down. That's what Mordechai was declaring in those moments of Kiddush Hashem. Unbelievable in the psukim over here. And lastly, and we'll end with this, one structural, or I guess more linguistic issue, if you go back to source number 1 in the psukim, is that the psukim declare, you know, the defiance of Mordechai HaTzadik. So they say, Mordechai lo yichra velo yishtachave. What does lo yichra mean? What does it mean? Mordechai lo yichra. Someone translate. I'm sorry?
He will.
So one of us said he would not bow down, but the other answer was he will not bow down. Lo yichra in the future tense, lo yichra. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachave. He will not bow down. He will not bow down. He will not prostrate himself before Haman. Why is it in the future tense? He wouldn't in the past. He didn't do it. We're telling a story here. Why are we talking about the future? So there are many pshatim in this pasuk. If you look in source 8 and source number 9, there are 4 that are included within the Sfas Emes and the Maharal over here that I think are very meaningful to all of us. If you look in source number 8, the Maharal's commentary, very, very lengthy and important fundamental commentary on Megillas Esther, but it's very hard to get through all of it because it's so sweeping. But again, you get pieces, nuggets here and there. The first answer he gives for why it's written in the future tense is because sometimes in the Hebrew language, we don't have time to get into examples of this, but we should one time. When's the next time I'm coming? Dr. Lehrer, when are you flying next? So if we talk about Psukim and Tanakh, sometimes you have a future tense that doesn't mean future. It actually just means consistent. It means always. It means always happening. Something is happening consistently. So lo yichra, says the Maharal, very interesting, doesn't mean that he won't in the future bow down. It means that he never would. He wouldn't. Consistently, he would not bow down. This happened again and again, like was pointed out before. This was a matter that happened all the time. It wasn't a one-off thing. He constantly would not bow down. Interesting. The second possibility the Maharal raised is also very fascinating, and it relates to the Gemara we mentioned earlier. He says, V'od, if you look in the second line of source number 8, in the underline, V'od, he says, lo yichra means that in the future he will not bow down. It doesn't mean in the future. It means lo yichra means if you said lo kara, that he wouldn't bow down, you would have thought that meant that every time Haman walked by, he wouldn't bow down. Lo yichra means he went out of his way to not bow down, meaning Haman was on the east corner of the street. Mordechai was on the west corner. He'd run to the east corner in order to not bow down. He found ways to get in Haman's face and say, I won't bow down. I won't give in. It wasn't enough, said Mordechai, at this time in Jewish history, to stand back and say, let's not get in a fight. Let's not get in any trouble. Let's not incite. He went out of his way to make sure the Kiddush Hashem was clear. He went out to make sure to show that the Jewish identity and the Jewish values were clear to the public. We live in a world in which incitement is absolutely incorrect. We should never be inciting the non-Jews. There's more of them. It's not a good bargain for us. But when that war is brought upon us, when the world is turned against us, it's not enough to cower in our corners and not cave. We have to stand strong. We have to be lo yichra. We have to find the corner where the fight is, and we have to stand tall. We have to do it responsibly. We have to do it respectfully. We have to do it in the arena in the way we can't lower ourselves to their level, but it is not enough to be on the other corner. There's an issue of lo yichra over here. There's a chilul Hashem and a kiddush Hashem at stake that demands that Jewish identity and Jewish values be called out actively. Proactively. We need to find opportunities to Mekadei Shem Shemayim. We need to find opportunities to declare Jewish values, to teach Jewish messages. Lefarsim ha'emuna hazos. To declare the Judaism's emuna in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. On the streets. In front of everyone. We need to look for those opportunities. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachla. He found opportunities to be Mekadei Shem Shemayim. That's a message we have to take home with us as well. Source number 9. You have the Sfas Emes. So he says 2 very, very fascinating points. And we'll end with this. He says, lo yichra v'lo yishtachav is an interesting terminology. It sounds like it's the future. But he says, you'll note that in Chumash, sometimes we have a yud, and it doesn't necessarily mean future, but it means something a little bit more esoteric. We have a pasuk that says, az yashir Moshe v'nei Yisrael, that Moshe Rabbeinu will sing or sing the song of the Yam, the Az Yashir that we say every single day. What does it mean, Yashir, in the future tense? So Rashi and Chumash, their quotes in Parashas Beshalach, that Yashir means Allah belibo, that it came into Moshe's heart, it arose in his mind that he should sing, and then he sang. But the Yashir, the Yud, means that it was Olib Machshava, it came into his mind that he should sing. So, and that's what the Maharal here, the Sasemis rather says, Ki ayud al shema machshava ne'emra. It means that it was on his mind that he wouldn't bow down. Okay, it was on his mind, of course, because he was doing it. So Maharal says, the Sasemis says something amazing. You look in the bold here. Lo Allah b'machashavto shum safik imichra. It's not like Haman walked by and Mordechai said, oof, let me check my Shulchan Aruch. Let me go to Yitor and see what they say about Mordechai bowing down. What am I supposed to do? He didn't have to think. It was instinctive. It was obvious. It was inherent in him that if Haman was going to walk down the street, he was going to defy orders. That he was going to make sure that he declared a Kiddush Hashem in the streets. That was obvious. Lo Allah b'machashavto, his mind was set on Kiddush Hashem. Lo yichra. It never dawned on him to bow down to sweat, to schwitz in front of Haman. It was built into his DNA that he would never do such a thing. It was instinctive. It was obvious. It was inherent to him that he wouldn't do that. That is a very lofty level. But you have to realize, that's not something that a Mordechai can learn the day of the challenge. It's something that's a lifetime of Kiddush Hashem. Mordechai swallowed, ate, drank Kiddush Hashem his entire life. He lived Kiddush Hashem throughout his entire life. So when the test came, he was ready. There was no thoughts. There was no doubts. There was no second idea. Maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. Lo alab machshavto shum safik im yichra. Obviously, lo yichra. This is what my whole life has led up to. When we want to pass these challenges, when we're challenged, and we are challenged every day right now with these issues of Kiddush and Chilul Hashem, when we have to not cave, we have to stand strong, it's not enough to make the decision on the spot. It has to be built on a bedrock of Jewish feelings, of Jewish values, of Jewish identity, of Torah values that are deep within us. And then lo yichra. We could pass the test of not being Korea, not being Mishtachaveh, one off each time. But to live a life of Kiddush Hashem, that's a different story entirely. We need to build that into ourselves and inculcate our kids with that as well in order to make sure that we're able to live up to that challenge without ever having a second thought. Lo yichra, v'lo yishtachaveh, it would never dawn on us to act in any way other than the way that we're acting. And lastly, ki ayud, says the Sfas Emes, al shem achshav nemra, gam pei rashnu ki achanu ledoros. The last pshat the Sfas Emes gives is that the idea over here of future tense is that, you know what, this is not only a storytelling hour, this is not only a message, this is not only a meaningful idea, but it's actually a promise. A promise that there will always be a Mordechai. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. In every generation, in every door, there will be strong ones. There will be people who we can look to, leaders, who will stand tall, who will defy those orders, who will be mekadesh shem shemayim barabim, who will be mefarsim ha'emuna azos in public, who will stand up against the Hamans of the generation, and it's your job to be one of those Mordechais. It's your job to see those Mordechais and see the lo yichra and see the lo yishtachaveh, the great promise of Jewish history, and say, I want a piece of that. I want a part of that. There's a promise that it'll be there, but it's up to you to latch on, to be part of that movement. So we need to take all of these messages. We have to understand what a Haman is, the Haman that we're facing, the Haman that we faced back then. We have to understand what it means to make Hadeshem Shemayim, as you spoke about, to declare those values. And then we have to find a way to inculcate those values so deeply into us that without any second thoughts, it's obvious that time and again, consistently, we're going to find ways proactively to go ahead and make Hadeshem Shemayim. B'siyat Hashemayim, if we do that, we'll do it forever. For many generations, in Mordechai, lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. I thank you all for joining, and it was wonderful to learn with you.